But anyways, we're in the book of Numbers, chapter 20, and we got partway through chapter 20. So basically, I ended, well, we're going to pick up with verse 14. Yeah, so we covered Moses and Aaron, you know, disobeying God, and admittedly, what might seem to us a small way, but in a way that really mattered, when God wanted them to bring water for the Israelites out of the rock. As I said, you know, they were supposed to talk to the rock. Instead, they yelled at the people and they hit the rock. God still provided water, but he told them, look, guys, there's going to be a penalty for this. Now, it's worth noting, though, that it's not the most severe penalty. It's not like Moses was 30 years old and had a long life ahead of him. He's 120. You know, we don't know how long he would have continued or if God might have had in mind that this was going to be the end. And that's all speculation. As I said, we don't know. We saw Miriam's end came early in the chapter before that event happened. And we're going to turn now to Aaron's end. Well, actually, we're not there yet. Let's go to verse 14. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. So remember, in this map, they've got Kadesh here. I've seen some where they put it a little further north. But they're sending to Edom, which is in this area. Interestingly, they send this message to the king of Edom saying, thus says your brother Israel, you know our hardship, how that has befallen us. It's going out of its way to show that, you know, the Israelites were well aware of the family relationship that they had with the people, you know, of Edom. And it's very likely that the people of Edom were also aware of it. So they point that out because they're going to make a request. Our hardship, how our fathers went down to Egypt, we dwelt there a long time, they afflicted us, we cried out, the Lord delivered us. And he jumps ahead quite a bit in history. He says, now here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your border. So, and he summarizes like 400 years of history pretty quickly, and now here we are, and basically we want to pass through. That's what it says in verse 17, please let us pass through your country. We're not going to go through the fields or vineyards, we're not going to trample stuff and ruin your crops. No, we won't even drink water from your wells. We'll go along the king's highway. I'll pause there just because that's the first place in the Bible that that phrase appears. Even though there are other writings and archaeological finds that show it's an ancient term, and it basically means a public roadway. It would be called the king's highway because it would be built and usually maintained at the king's expense. But of course, the king's using money he gets from taxes to do that. But they're still saying, look, we're just going through on the road. It'd be like if I said, you know, I'm passing through on the interstate and I'm not going to take any exits. Then Edom sends a message back. You shall not pass through my land, lest I come out against you with the sword. Moses isn't going to give up with just one try. The children of Israel said, no, we'll go by the highway. And if I or my livestock drink any of your water, we'll pay for it. Just let me pass through on foot, nothing more. And paying for water, well, actually, when I was young, paying for water would be something people would laugh at because you can get water out of a faucet for free. Nowadays, people buy bottles of water all the time, so it doesn't seem as laughable. But in a land, you know, they're down here in a semi-arid area, so it was normal to charge a tax for the use of a well. So them offering to pay for water is also a pretty normal thing, it seems. But still, Edom, you know, isn't willing to relent. In verse 20, you will not pass through. Edom came out against him with many men and a strong hand. They bring out the army to face Israel, which is kind of a shame because the Israelites, it should have been apparent if they send anybody out to look. They're peaceful. It's not an invading army. They've got women and children and all these livestock. You know, they're no way a threat necessarily, but Edom doesn't want to take chances with that. So they refuse by any means. And Israel, yeah, this is verse 21, Israel turned away from him. I mentioned this yesterday, I think when we were talking about the book of Obadiah, it's in Judges chapter 11, verses 16 through 18, that Jephthah wrote the letter that describes some of what we're seeing here, how Israel asked permission and then they would end up taking the land away from the Amorites. It was Judges 11, verses 16 through 18. Now, I want to make a note here because it sounds like they leave and that's it. There's a slight contradiction when Moses is retelling this later in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 28 and 29, he seems to indicate that some Edomites did allow passage and sell water. Now, I don't believe the Bible contradicts itself, so the idea might be what we're going to see is that they are going to pass all the way around Edom, so maybe on the outskirts they passed through some Edomite territory and were able to pay to use water. But it's not entirely clear. But that's what I would gather from what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 2. Now we see they're not getting along on a friendly basis, certainly not the king. And as we'd see, Edom is going to be at enmity with Israel for centuries. God will eventually prophesy punishment on Edom. I think it's interesting, the first thing I've got in my notes is the book of Obadiah talks about that. Jeremiah chapter 49 and Ezekiel 25 are all focused on Edom and the punishment God promised. But as I said, rather than fight them, the Israelites move away. Now, before they go all the way around, though, verse 22 says they're going to go to Mount Hor, H-O-R. And the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron. You know, they're there by the border of Edom and says, Aaron will be gathered to his people. And you've probably been reading the Bible long enough to know that gathered to your people means you're going to die. But it indicates a peaceful death, not like death in battle or auto accident or anything like that. But, you know, natural end, you know, some places it talks about being full of days, gathered to your people, resting with your fathers. As we mentioned, Aaron is 123 years old. So God says, okay, it's time. But he's going to pass the high priesthood on to his oldest son, Eleazar. But he does mention in verse 24 that one of the reasons this is happening now and not after they crossed the Jordan River in the Promised Land was that incident at Meribah. For Moses and Aaron both, failing to give God the proper credit for giving the water. So it's to take Aaron and Eleazar, his son, bring them up to Mount Hor. So they're going to go up high. We could question whether what's going to happen is a public ceremony, like people can see them up there. I tend to think they go up and people don't see them. You know, you can't always see when people go up a mountain what they're doing. But there is some sort of ceremony, it seems. Moses would basically take the priestly robes from Aaron. The word you would use for that is divestiture. You know, vestment being the word that relates to clothing. We use it now for investments, but a divestiture is taking it off, and then when they put the robes on Eleazar, that's an investiture. So both of these happen, symbolically showing now Eleazar is the high priest. So verse 27, Moses did as the Lord commanded. Verse 28, Moses stripped Aaron of his garments, put them on Eleazar, his son. Aaron died there on the top of the mountain. I'm presuming, though it doesn't say so, that they buried him up there. But it says, then Moses and Eleazar came down, and all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, and they mourned 30 days. So they see three men go up the mountain. They see two men come back. And Aaron was full of days, as I said, 123 years old. And God allows full honors and respected Aaron's death. Perhaps him dying here where he does is a punishment, but God doesn't dishonor Aaron in that way. As I said, he's allowed the formal mourning and the respect that would come with that. As a matter of fact, there's some question of whether the public at large even knew about the punishment. We could debate it either way. It's not clear. But when God spoke to Moses and Aaron after they brought the water out of the rock, it doesn't say, you know, that he spoke publicly. It doesn't say that he didn't. But I imagine that God, you know, the way he sent the water anyways, I imagine him taking them aside afterwards and letting them know that they were going to be punished, but it wasn't for public. You know, it's sort of something they say a rule in leadership is what, praise in public and correct in private. I suspect God might have done that. Although, again, it's still me speculating. Moving on in chapter 21. The king of Arad, the Canaanite, who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to Atharim, and he fought against Israel and took some prisoners. So somebody ambushes them from behind. And we're not sure exactly where it is. The old King James, instead of Atharim, said way of the spies. But we think that this translation is better. Most scholars say, no, that should have been a proper name. It might refer to the king having sent some spies to figure out what the Israelites were doing. And so they do this. Verse 2, Israel makes a vow to the Lord. If you'll deliver this people into my hands, I'll utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord listened to the voice. and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them. Remember, Harem? That's pretty much what's going on here. Now, this is another case where I want to mention a later scripture that makes us question if, you know, this could be interpreted a couple ways. One is right then, before they circle around Edom and get ready to enter the Promised Land, they fight a little battle against that king and destroy them. But it's also possible that what they did here is they make this commitment to God. If you'll deliver them, when I get the chance, I'll wipe them out. And the reason I bring that up is later in Joshua chapter 12, there's a long list of the cities and their kings that the Israelites destroyed. And the king of Arad is specifically mentioned in that list in Joshua 12 and verse 14. So that seems to indicate that what we just saw described here happened later, possibly. I mean, I don't think it makes a big difference either way, but again, I like to clear up any possible conflicts or discrepancies where people might say, you know, the Bible contradicts itself. At any rate, after that's done, Israelites go on their journey. They journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. They became very discouraged. Yeah, I think some translations mention Eilat. So the way of the Red Sea is meaning the Gulf of Aqaba all the way down here. So they're up near the Promised Land. Now they're going down here in a pretty arid area and rough terrain. It's, you know, not that I've been there, but from what photos I've seen and descriptions, it's not a place you want to go taking a hike, and it's a lot further distance. So the people are weary, they're hot, they're probably tired and thirsty, and they get discouraged. And what do Israelites do when they get discouraged and uncomfortable? You know, they start grumbling and complaining. As we see that, at the end of verse 4, the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way, and the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no food, no water. Our soul loathes this worthless bread. I find that interesting. This disparagement, they're referring to manna, I'm pretty sure. And by calling it worthless, the Hebrew scholars say seems to imply that it doesn't have nutritional value. You know, it's just light, airy stuff. And I thought, no nutritional value. They've been living on it for 40 years. So I think it does, or maybe they're tired of it for whatever way, but God sends a punishment. He sends fiery serpents among the people. I wanted to give you the word for that because it's related to some others. F-I-E-R-Y. Snakes would have been easier to spell. See, N-A-N-N-E-C-H-A-S-H-I-M. And then H-A-S-S-E-R-A-P-H-I-M. Let me see if I can say. Nanekashim Haseraphim. Well, it's two words for the fiery serpents. The reason I'm bringing it out is the base word seraphim appears in this one. And we saw seraphim in Isaiah chapter 6. When Isaiah saw a vision of God's throne, he saw angels that he called seraphim. Or remember, that's a plural, seraphs. And we had some question, what does that mean? And the word seraph or seraphim is a Hebrew word that in Isaiah 6 wasn't translated. It means literally bright or glowing or burning. And it fits here, they're talking about the snakes. We're not sure if it's because of the snake's color or perhaps when they're bite, the wound caused a burning sensation. But I wanted to make the point that that word is used referring to angels later, which seems in some ways troubling. And what's going to happen is troubling. Of course, the people were upset and they repent, at least outwardly, in verse 7. We've sinned. We've spoken against the Lord. Pray to the Lord that he'll take away the serpents. God says, okay, it's nice that you said this, but I'm going to make you go through a symbolic action to have be healed. The Eternal said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and it'll be that everyone who's bitten when he looks at it will live. So Moses made a bronze serpent, put it on a pole. And so it was, if a serpent had bitten anyone, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. And this is one of the unusual stories in here. This is the only place where we see something quite like this happen. And it seems puzzling in some ways, because if you think of a snake in the Bible, what's that usually representing? Okay, David says Satan. I heard some mumbling out there. Yeah, we think of the Garden of Eden, the story in Genesis chapter 3. You might also think of Revelation 12, verse 9, or that serpent of old, the dragon, the devil and Satan. So yeah, we see that symbolism. But this putting the serpent on a pole, Jesus Christ would later say, is a foreshadow of his crucifixion. It's in John chapter 3 and verse 14. I'm not going to turn there. I'll just tell you the essence of what it says. John 3 and verse 14, Jesus is telling people, "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up." And I think that, you know, after the fact, the apostles wrote that, you know, signifying his crucifixion. He was put up on this pole or cross. So we see these two different representations. What I've seen, I think there could be a reconciliation if we think of what it says in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 21. In 2 Corinthians 5, 21, Paul basically says that Christ became sin for us. And so this might be, you know, when Christ is put up on the crucifix, that at least at some moment, all the sins of mankind were on him. And if you remember, before he died, Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Some people have said that that implies that even the Father turned his back on him. He lost that connection because he was representing sin. So maybe there's a connection of this serpent that seems to represent sin being equated to Christ's crucifixion. Not that Christ represents sin, but him dying for sin. And that's a little side. I think I've mentioned this. I like to answer questions like that because I don't know how many times over my life people at church have come up and they say, "You went to Ambassador College. What did they teach you about this? And they'll come up with some question like that. And I go, A lot of times they have a question that I've never even heard of. And I say, "They didn't teach me anything about it." But I'm trying to equip you for some of the things I can do. Well, and we know, do you remember what happened in the end with this bronze serpent? It stuck around for a while, right? Maybe, yeah, Charlie? It was kind of in passing.
Didn't they start worshiping it?
Yes. It's referenced in 2 Kings 18, verse 4. And centuries later, it says they're burning incense to it, indicating worship. And so Hezekiah, when he led the religious reform in Judah, destroyed it then. So it endures all the way from before the Israelites inherit the promised land until King Hezekiah is on the throne. So I guess it's a good thing it was made out of bronze, not paper mache. It was able to last a long time. Okay, anyways, that incident happens. I think it's kind of interesting, but then they move on. Verse 10, the children of Israel moved on and camped at Oboth. They journeyed from Oboth at Ajeb Abarim in the wilderness that's east of Moab towards the sunrise. And from there they camped at Zered, and I should be skipping over this, but as I like better on the map, basically they go around. It's a long ways to get where they're going. And it's worth noting, 38 years earlier, it seems that God planned to lead them in from the south to conquer the promised land. There's no explanation of why, but now it seems God plans to bring them in from the east, which is indeed what happened. And of course, we know there'll be a miracle of, you know, stopping the Jordan River and them going across. I suppose it's even possible that God planned this route so he could work a miracle that paralleled parting the Red Sea. But again, that would be sheer guessing on my part. But in any event, they go through and there's all these landmarks mentioned, or not all these, there's a few. You know, like it mentions the Valley of Zered in verse 12. It and the Arnon River, which I don't see on here, basically, you have some rivers that feed. There's a mountainous area here. They're called the Mountains of Moab. And they feed those rivers that feed in, that drain down into the Dead Sea. And, of course, the Dead Sea doesn't have an outlet. It just loses its water by evaporation, and that's why it has such a high mineral content. But it does have streams flowing into it, not as big as the Jordan, but some others. So they're doing that. Yeah, in verse 4, I was looking at verse 14. Therefore, it said in the book of the wars of the eternal, and there's this little poem. Scholars have had a lot of speculation on what exactly was the Book of the Wars of the Lord, but we simply don't know. We'd just be guessing. It didn't become part of the Bible, so we don't see, you know, it's not around where we could look at it. It might have been a collection of songs or poems. I've seen the speculation that it might have been some instructions for Joshua that Moses wrote before he died. And for some reason, Moses, in this particular chapter of Numbers, quotes a few poems. I don't know if he was just in a poetry mood that day or what. But, you know, it describes where they're at, you know, on the border of Moab, along the brooks. Verse 16 says, they went from there to Beer, which is the well where the Lord said to Moses, gather the people together and I'll give them water. I like this one. Here God gives them water with no grumbling, no complaint, no hitting a rock or speaking to it. And Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, all of you sing it. The well the leaders sank, dug by the nation's nobles, by the lawgiver with their staves. You know, some scholars that I've read say the Hebrew indicates that the princes found a well rather than that they actually dug it. And if they did do digging, it probably wasn't with walking sticks, unless the ground was really soft. But at any rate, you know, there's not the trouble getting water in this particular case. Now, starting in verse 21, we see that Moses is going to do the same thing with the Amorites that he did with the Edomites. He'll send a message saying, look, I just want to go peacefully through your land. We're not going to take your food. We're not going to ruin your fields. We're not going to drink your water unless we pay for it. You know, as it says in verse 22, we'll pass by on the king's highway. So this is to Sihon, king of the Amorites. Verse 23, Sihon would not allow Israel to pass through. Sihon gathered his people together against Israel. So he musters the army and comes out to fight. Well, God did not allow Israel to fight against either Edom or Moab. And that reminds me, I'm not sure if I skipped the reference. Well, we'll find it later. When Moses tells the generation of Israel, recounts all of this happening in Deuteronomy, he'll tell them that God told me, I'm not giving you Edom's land. They're your brothers, you can't have their land. And he would say the same thing about Moab and about Ammon, because God gave them their lands, but doesn't say anything like that about the Amorites. They're Canaanites. And so when they come to fight Israel, Israel fights against them. And as we see in verse 24, Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the people of Ammon, for the border of the people of Ammon was fortified. I'm looking for, might be better, the Ammonites, some maps show them up close and some further out. But here's the river Arnon, that brook Zered. So basically, the Israelites wipe out the Amorites here. We're going to see that they're going to take on Bashan. So Edom will be down here, Moab, Ammon, but Israel is going to take a lot of territory. And I don't want to read every word, but I don't want to skip too much. In verse 26, Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all his land. This indicates that the Moabites had a lot of this land, and then the Amorites had come and conquered it and taken it away from Moab. So now God allows Israel to conquer the Amorites and take it back. And then we see this little poem in verses 27 through 30. And Moses seems here to be quoting from, some say, an ancient war song. And it has three basic parts. Rather than read it, I'll say verses 27 and 28 discuss the bitterness of the Amorite conquest from Moab. So the Amorites came and conquered some of Moab's land, and that's a bad thing. Then in verse 29, you know, Israel shows compassion for Moab, but they're also a little critical and sarcastic, criticizing their false god, Chemosh. It says, you have perished, O people of Chemosh, and sort of implying that's kind of why you couldn't stand up against them. And then in verse 30, there's revenge by Israel against Sihon the Amorite. So the Israelites do this. Yeah, in verse 31, then Israel dwelt in the land of the Amorites, and Moses sent to spy out Jazer and took its villages and drove out the Amorites who were there. And they turned and went up by the way of Bashan. So Og, the king of Bashan, went out against them and all his people to battle. I always feel like I should comment on King Og, just because it's such an intriguing name. Seems like he should be a pro wrestler or something like that. What's your name? Og. But I don't want to make too much fun of him because, you know, he'll come up in the resurrection and we'll hang out together and he'll probably turn out to be a really good guy. So what we see here is, you know, by the end of the chapter, Israel has conquered a whole territory because God gave them the power to do so. The land that was the Amorites here, then up here you can see Bashan is spelled out. You might not be able to read it, but this is what later we'll call the Transjordan area. It's east of the Jordan that becomes Israel. Now, up to this point, we haven't had the point, you know, we haven't reached the time where some of the tribal leaders will come to Moses and say, hey, we'd like to live here instead of crossing over. But it seems perhaps God did have that in mind, because I'm not sure why he'd have them conquer it and move it all out otherwise. That land of Bashan, the name itself refers to the rich soil in the area. So up there, you know, it's a plains land and it's rich soil. I think of what might be the equivalent in America is like in Iowa and Nebraska, where it's fairly flat and fewer trees than further east, but really good soil. And that's what it's known for, being good soil. And again, a lot of the story was recounted by the judge Jephthah in Judges chapter 11. And he has a pretty good summary. I thought Jephthah, for being an outcast, was a pretty good writer. Okay, I'm pausing because we're getting ready to jump into chapter 22. Oh, yeah, Julie?
You said verse 30 was revenge by Israel?
Yeah, against Sihon the Amorite. Basically, yeah, the Israelites defeated Sihon. That's an interesting name, too, but it's harder to say. Not like Og. Okay, so I was going to make the point. We're about to enter what many times is referred to as the Balaam oracles. Although a lot of times we don't say the oracles start until chapter 23, when Balaam actually starts to speak. But Balaam is an interesting character. I'll mention that, and then we'll go into it. But this is one of the famous stories in the Bible. And what's in chapter 22 has a subpart of the story that's also very famous. But the children of Israel moved and camped on the plains of Moab, on the side of Jordan across from Jericho. So I'm trying to think where. Yeah, so they're over here. Now Jericho's there. They've moved in, and they're going to be there for a while. Matter of fact, they're going to be there for the rest of this class. Not just today's session, but I mean until graduation. And that you picked up with them leaving there at the start of the school year with Joshua leading them across the Jordan. So, as I mentioned, you know, the Pentateuch starts with, creation. It focuses on Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, the Israelites go to Egypt. We have this time at Sinai. Then they're moving up, and they don't enter the promised land. They wander for 40 years, and then they come up, and they're perched on the edge of the promised land for the last book of the Pentateuch and a few more chapters. So that's where they're at now. And we'll have some events and then a lot of Moses talking to them, with some of God talking to Moses. But we've got the story of Balaam, of course, first. So the Israelites are camped there on the plains of Moab, and Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. It's like, these people are formidable. They wiped out the Amorites. So he's a little scared. Don't know if there's anything to it, but Balak could have been translated to mean empty, I think, in the Hebrew language. So I don't know, but it could have just been his parents liked the sound of the name. And he is scared, but it's worth connecting this to Deuteronomy 2 and verse 25. In Deuteronomy 2, 25, it says that God put the fear of Israel in the other nations. So he had reason to be afraid, but it seems that there was some supernatural inspiration there. So, yeah, he's sick with dread because of the children of Israel, it says at the end of verse 3. So Moab said to the elders of Midian, these are a nomadic and scattered peoples, perhaps living among Moabites, but also further to the east. We think they're descended from Ishmael, but there's some dispute on scholarly sources. Moses had connections with Midianites. Remember, his father-in-law was a Midianite, so was his wife. But he doesn't seem to have connection with these Midianites because they're not friendly. At least that's a guess. But anyways, you know, Moab said to the elders of Midian, this company is going to lick up everything around us like an ox licks up the grass. It's like they're going to eat us up. There's not going to be anything left. Verse 5, he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor at Pethor, which is near the river, which is good. I didn't know where Pethor was, but it's near the river. When it says the river, what's that? It's the Euphrates. So it's the Israelites are over here. We don't know exactly where Pethor was, but Balaam's not right next door. He's over here. He's living either in the land, the empire that would become Assyria or Babylonia. He's a ways off, but he's got a reputation. He's known all the way to Moab. What else I want to say about him? The name Balaam can be translated as destroyer of the people. I'd probably have a big head if I had a name that meant destroyer of the people. But as I said, evidently he was widely known and thought to have some kind of mystical powers, because the king of Moab is going to be willing to pay him to put a curse on Israel. Matter of fact, you know, I should read. Yeah, okay, let's just read a little bit. Verse 5, he sent messengers saying, to call him, saying, look, a people has come from Egypt. They cover the face of the earth. They're settling next to me. Please come at once and curse this people for me. They're too mighty for me. Perhaps I'll be able to defeat them. It's telling at the end of verse 6, he says, I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. So him saying he knows that shows that people at least believed Balaam had some kind of power. Now, I could make the point that a lot of times people know things that aren't true, but it's possible Balaam had some connection to the spirit world. I would even go so far as to say it's likely. I'll mention in 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, Peter refers to Balaam as a prophet, although he mentions the madness of the prophet. But prophet is someone that God communicates through. We might wonder, did Peter call him a prophet because in the next couple chapters we'll see that God would communicate through Balaam? Or, you know, is there something else? And I'm raising questions that I don't have the answer to. But we could consider Balaam is considered this kind of prophet with magical powers. Perhaps he had dealings with the spirit world, probably with fallen spirits, with demons. And we're going to find out that he knows the name of the true God. He refers to him as Yahweh, a name that God revealed to Moses. We don't have reason to believe it was widely known, although God revealed it to Moses more than 40 years earlier. I'll mention this. Balaam is known in Jewish tradition as the one who taught Israel to sin. Now, I would hesitate there because Israel, we've seen quite a few sins already before Balaam comes into the story, but he will, you know, be involved in some of this. At any rate, Balak thinks that he can hire Balaam to use whatever power or influence he has with the spirit world to curse Israel. He's going to learn that's not true. But the messengers, verse 7, the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the diviner's fee. So they're coming with money. They came to Balaam, spoke the words of Balak. Balaam tells them, lodge here tonight and I'll bring back word as the Lord speaks to me. So they stayed with him. And God came to Balaam. So God does speak to Balaam. I wish I had answers to the questions that come into my mind, because I think, is this the first time God ever spoke to Balaam? Or had, you know, he's communicated with him before? Because we don't see anything in Balaam's character to make us think that he had a good relationship with God. So maybe this is the first time. As I said, he's going to refer to the Eternal by name. I say we could say maybe Balaam had some dealings with the true God, or something, you know, and I guess this is my own personal speculation, and by the way, keep in mind where I'm speculating, but maybe Balaam did communicate with evil spirits, and through them he'd heard of this powerful God who delivered the children of Israel and worked these miracles. So now he's thinking, hey, I get to deal with that guy. It's like if you're a minor league baseball player and you get called up to the majors. That'd be kind of a big deal, at least I think. I'm not much of a ball player, so. But I would think that's a big deal. So he's eager to do this. God talks to him, but he doesn't tell him what he wants to hear. Well, God first asks, who are these men? Well, Balak, the son of Zippor, sent to me saying, these people has come, curse them for me. Verse 12, God says to Balaam, no, you can't go with them. You shall not curse a people. They're blessed. Oh, man, I wanted that money. Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes, go back. The Lord has refused to give me permission to go. I like the way he words it. It's obvious that he wishes he could go. You know, he wanted to go, but the Lord refused. Well, verse 15, Balak doesn't realize that Balaam is being directed by God. He probably thinks he's holding out for more money. So, verse 15, Balak sent princes more numerous and more honorable. They came to Balaam and said, thus says Balak of Zippor, please let nothing hinder you from coming. I'll honor you greatly. I'll do whatever you say. It's almost like they're sending him a blank check. You fill in the number. Just whatever you want, just as long as you come and do this for us. And I think we've studied the story, or many of you probably read it before. Balaam said, well, even if Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I couldn't go beyond the word of the Lord my God. Interesting, again, here he's saying the Lord my God. It makes us wonder, what's gone on in Balaam's life before he shows up here in Numbers chapter 22? And we just don't know. You know, I look forward to finding out one of these days. Or he could just be making a false claim, saying he's his God, when really God is saying, I don't know you. I mean, if Jesus says, people will come saying, didn't I work miracles in your name and all this? And he'll say, I never knew you. So could be a case of something like that. Anyways, verse 20, God comes to Balaam at night again and says, well, if these men come to call you, go with them. But you can only speak the word that I give to you. Now, well, what we see what happens next is Balaam rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went. And it says in verse 22, God was angry. You know, depending on how you read this, you could say, well, God said he could go with him. Why is he angry? You know, so it depends on how you interpret that. But I've heard most often that God told Balaam, if they come to get you, and Balaam jumped the gun, is that he's not going to wait to see if they come. He's going to get up and go to them to make sure he doesn't miss out. And that probably made God angry. He could have also been angry because it's clear Balaam wants this money. He's willing to curse God's people to get it. So, I don't know. Move on to verse 23. Now, the interesting story with the donkey. Reminds me, I've got a donkey costume at home. It's not made for me, it's made for a little kid. I don't know. We used to do some plays for the preteen kids back in Columbus. We did a play version of this. It was my wife's idea. So I ended up making a donkey costume that I still have. I wonder if it'd fit Connor now. Might have to try that. Anyway, sorry, that popped into my mind. It doesn't have a lot to do with this other than we did the whole story. And as I said, the Balaam donkey talking to Balaam is a very famous story. And it reminds us that God will sometimes allow certain people to see things and other people to not see things. I mean, literally in this case, but we could also say figuratively in understanding and seeing the truth. In this case, you know, an angel goes out to resist Balaam, you know, riding on the donkey, and the donkey can see it and Balaam can't. So we see that in verse 23. Donkey saw the angel of the Lord with his sword drawn, so the donkey walked out into the field. Balaam didn't see the angel. He just thinks his donkey's going crazy, so he starts beating it probably with a stick. Donkey gets back on the road. The angel stood further ahead in a narrow path between a vineyard with a wall on this side and a wall on the other. Donkey tries to squeeze past and crushes Balaam's foot, so he's angry and beats the donkey again. And then the angel moves up to a place where the road's even narrower. There's no room to get by, so the donkey just lays down. And by this time, Balaam's had enough. He just starts beating the thing. He's so angry. And the donkey turns around and starts talking to him. I'll stop there because I want to back up. I saw something in my notes I wanted to remember that, you know, one of the lessons here is, was the donkey trying to hinder Balaam or be inconvenient? You know, Balaam is really angry at this donkey, but the donkey saved his life. You know, because the angel says later, if she hadn't avoided it, I would have killed you. And I'll make the point that if God wanted Balaam killed at this point, he would have made sure it happened. So it's not like the donkey saved him against God's will. But maybe there's a lesson in this. Sometimes the things that frustrate us and make us angry are actually things that are good for us. Maybe Balaam's trying to go make a trip somewhere and having trouble getting there. You know, you think, how many times have you been driving along and you get in a traffic jam or something? It's like, oh, this is taking forever. But maybe if you'd gone on time, you would have been in an accident or something like that. I'm not the first person to say something like that, I'm sure, but it's worth considering. Now, I mentioned, of course, starting in verse 28, the donkey's going to talk. And a lot of times people have used this as an excuse. How many times have you heard people say, well, if the Lord can speak through a donkey, he can talk through me. And then they start blah, 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 saying whatever they have on their mind to say. At least I've heard that before. But it's worth noting, you know, this story shouldn't be taken as an excuse to speak out when it's a time you should keep quiet. In my notes, I put Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 4. You know, there is a time to be more ready to listen than to speak. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 4. And I'll make the point, in verse 28, it says, the Lord opened the donkey's mouth. The donkey didn't open its mouth and start speaking on its own, so God decided it was time to get this message out. You know, I said, what have you done? What have I done that you struck me three times? And Balaam seems to not be so surprised that he doesn't talk back. That's one of the things that always, you know, I'd be looking and say, what? Did you just talk to me? He just starts talking back. Maybe because he realizes that it's a divine miracle. Either that or he talks to donkeys a lot. I'm not sure. But one thing I'll say, we should not take this story to mean that animals actually have intelligence and they could talk if we just understood their language. And I'm thinking of Dr. Doolittle. Doesn't work that way. You know, this is something God worked a miracle in this particular case. As much as I'd like my dog to talk to me, she won't. A lot of times she doesn't even want to look at me, but that's a whole other story. So anyways, the lesson comes out, though. Balaam's angry, says, you've abused me, and then the donkey says, I'm your donkey. I've never acted this way before. Then in verse 31, the Lord opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel there with a drawn sword. Now Balaam is humble. He falls flat on his face. and basically, the angel says, look, if not for the donkey, I'd have killed you. Well, verse 34, Balaam says, well, I've sinned. Here's some at least superficial repentance. I didn't know you were there. If it displeases you, I'll turn back. And again, here I'm making the point that if God really wanted Balaam killed, that it would have happened. So it's not like the donkey thwarted God's will. I think God's will was to reinforce to Balaam what he told him before. You're going here at my pleasure. You're going to say only what I want you to say. Balaam probably wouldn't forget that or take it lightly after this experience. And we'll see it plays out exactly. Balaam says the exact opposite of what he's wanting to make money for doing. And maybe this whole incident was to make sure that that's what happened. Anyways, we could make the point, Balak, the king of Moab, had not learned that lesson. He wasn't around for any of this. When we get to verse 36, Balak heard that Balaam was coming. He went out to meet him. Balak said to Balaam, didn't I call you earnestly? Am I not able to honor you? Basically, can't I pay you a bunch of money? Balaam reminded him, perhaps of a lesson that had just been reinforced, look, I don't have any power to say anything except what God tells me. I'm paraphrasing what it says in verse 38. So Balaam went with Balak. They came to Kirjath-Huzoth. Balak offered oxen and sheep and sent some to Balaam and the princes who were with him. So basically, they sacrificed to their false gods. They offered these animals so they can have a big feast, a big party, getting ready for Balaam to go do his thing. Okay, I said, looking, what did I miss here? I will mention in verse 38, Balaam says, have I any power to say anything? The word that the Lord puts in my mouth, I'll speak. It sounds respectful, but part of me says, is he being kind of like a sullen child? Like, oh, I can only say what God lets me. You know, yeah, I could see me doing that if I were in a bad attitude. So, and that fits with the rest of the story. We know Balaam wants to do things that he's not allowed to do. And so, in some ways, there's lessons for that, for us in that. I've got a minute or two. I want to stop there because it's worth noting verse 41 seems to belong more appropriately to chapter 23, because that begins the story of them going out and offering these sacrifices and Balaam pronouncing the message God wants instead of the message he wants. So a lot of scholars would have broken the chapter a little bit differently, but I'm going to stop there, so I'll do it the way I think it could have or should have been done. That'll give us a little time.